Chapter 34. The executioner examined the room critically. He was alone for now, but there was plenty of space for witnesses, though they had been forced to use a lottery system to choose the lucky ones. The black backdrop, a piece of thick cloth hung from a pipe, was in place. The camera sat on its tripod and had already been tested. The uplink worked perfectly. There was thick plastic sheeting on the floor to make cleanup afterward a bit easier. He recalled the first time he'd used a sword to decapitate a man. His victim's heart had been racing and his blood pressure dangerously high, so when the head came free, it was like a fountain. So much blood erupted from the stump that they opted to abandon the safe house in Baghdad they had used rather than clean the mess. Tonight would be his 11th. And for him, the most satisfying. He'd never killed a woman before. At least, not with a sword. Since taking up arms, he'd killed dozens of women in bombings from Indonesia to Morocco, and in firefights with Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq. Stray rounds had certainly hit others. He gave them little thought. Al-Jama had issued orders, and he had carried them out. There was no more weight on his conscience than had he been told to shake his victim's hands rather than blow them up. Of course, the irony and open secret within the organization was that he wasn't a practicing Muslim. He'd been born into the faith, but his parents hadn't been devout followers, so he'd visited mosques only on holy days. He'd only come to Al-Jama after a hitch with the French Foreign Legion had given him a taste for combat that he had yet to slake. He fought and killed and maimed for himself, not for some insane religious conviction that slaughter was somehow Allah's will. He didn't try to understand the motivations of those who fought with him, so long as they followed orders. He did admit, however, that the fear of missing out on paradise kept the fighters motivated to a degree only the best trained armies could achieve. And the ability to talk people into blowing themselves up was a weapon unlike any other in the arsenals of the world. It went so against the West's precepts for the preservation of life that the effects rippled from the blast's epicenter to the very hearts of any who learned of it. A subaltern knocked softly at the doorframe behind him.
"Does everything meet your needs, Mansour?"
"Yes," he said absently. "This will be fine."
"When should we get the American whore?"
"Not until just before her execution. It's been my experience that they are most terrified in those first moments when they realize their death is upon them."
"As you wish. If you need anything further, I am just outside."
The executioner didn't bother to reply, and the man stepped out of view again. He doubted there would be any pleas for mercy from the woman. He'd observed her only briefly, but had a strong sense of her defiance. He actually preferred it that way. The men loved the crying and wailing, but he found it bothersome. Yes, that was the word, bothersome. Better to accept fate, he believed, than to demean yourself in worthless begging. He wondered if they actually believed carrying on would stop their execution. By the time they met him, their death was an inevitability, and pleading was as useless as trying to stave off an avalanche by raising your arms protectively. No, the woman would not beg. "Watch the right flank," Linda said, and fired a controlled burst over the soccer's rail. "They're trying to get around us by crawling along the rubble wall." The muzzle flash drew counterfire from four different points. Eric had been ready for it, crouched 20 feet farther along the deck. He raked the spot where one of the terrorists was hiding, but in the cavern's absolute darkness, he had no idea if he'd hit anything. In the first furious seconds of the gunfight, both sides scrambled to organize themselves after the surprise encounter. Linda quickly ordered her people onto the soccer, which offered the best cover on short notice, while the terrorist leader shouted at his men to conserve ammunition and prepare for an all-out assault. They came swiftly, flicking their flashlights on and off like lightning bugs in order to see the terrain but not overly expose themselves. The corporation team concentrated their fire on the men with the lights before realizing their mistake. The men carrying torches only turned them on when they were behind cover. The beams were meant for others scouting ahead. "Come on, come on," Mark chided himself as he tore through his pack, tossing aside gear with abandon. "I know it's in here." Bullets stitched the side of the ship, several winging through a gun port and splintering wood inches from where he crouched. Linda called to Eric, "On my mark. Go!" They both popped up and let loose. In their scramble to find cover, a terrorist accidentally stepped into the beam of his partner's light. He was climbing the old riverbank to gain access to the pier. Had he reached it, he would have been able to hose the deck and end the battle single-handedly. The beam barely caressed his leg, but it was enough. Linda adjusted her aim, approximated where his torso would be, and fired again. She was rewarded with a scream that echoed over the rattling assault rifles. She and Eric both ducked down when rounds filled the air around them.
"This is crazy," Eric panted.
He couldn't see her saucy grin, but heard it in her voice when she said,
"I've never been in a firefight that wasn't."
Something heavy rattled against the Socker's stern.
"Down!"
Linda shouted. An instant later, a grenade exploded. The shrapnel flew over the prone figures, tearing away more of the ship's woodwork. Linda's ears rang, but she didn't let it distract her. The grenade was meant to keep them pinned for seconds only, and she was determined not to give them even that. She peered over the rail. Lights flickered from one side of the cavern entrance to the other. Linda fought the raw fear running through her veins. It was really 2 against 12, since Alana didn't have a weapon, and Mark Murphy couldn't shoot to save his life. She searched an ammo pouch hanging from her combat harness and pinched off a wad of plastique. By feel, she selected a 60-second timing pencil, rammed it home, and tossed it over the side. She laid down another 3-round burst and ducked back again.
"We've got to stop them flanking us," she called across to Eric. "I tossed some plastique. When it blows, find some targets."
She took the opportunity to change out her magazine, uncertain how many rounds she'd fired. If they had time, she would have Alana consolidate the spare ammunition in fresh clips. The blast came a moment later. The concussion was like a kick to the chest, and she'd been ready for it. The fireball crashed against the ceiling, bathing the cavern in demonic light. Linda and Eric opened up. Terrorists who were caught in the open raced for cover, rounds screaming past them before the pair could zero in and put the men down. Return fire came from 8 different directions. Linda's chin was bloodied by a shard of wood torn from the rail, and as much as she didn't want to lose the last of the light, she had to stay under cover from such a deadly barrage. When it lessened, she fired blind at the riverbank below the quay in case anyone was trying to climb it again. Then, over the sharp stench of cordite, she smelled a familiar odor. Wood smoke. She looked aft just as the smoldering decking that had been hit by the grenade caught fire. The flame was low and smoky, but every second saw it grow. If it got out of control, they were as good as dead. The Socker would become their funeral pyre.
"Mark, get that. We'll cover you."
Alana crawled from his side and approached Linda.
"He's working on something. I've got it."
"Stay low," Linda cautioned, impressed with the archaeologist's courage. The flames rose higher, first illuminating only the ship's stern. But like a rising sun, the light's reach expanded rapidly. The terrorists used this to their advantage. They could see the vessel more clearly, and their accuracy improved. 30 feet from Linda, Alana slithered right to the edge of the burning section. She saw it wasn't the deck afire, but a bench for the helmsman. She swung onto her back, braced her feet under the burning seat, and heaved. Rather than fly over the side of the ship, the bench broke in two, showering her with embers. Alana beat out the ashes where they seared her skin, ripped her t-shirt over her head, and with nothing to protect her skin but the thin cotton, she worked on snuffing out the fire by hand.
All the while, Linda and the gunman traded shots over her head. By the time Alana extinguished the last of the stubborn flames, her shirt had all but burned up, and most of the skin on her palms was gone, leaving behind nothing but raw red meat that hurt like nothing she'd ever experienced in her life. The pain was so intense she couldn't crawl on her hands and knees, but rather had to slither like a snake to return to the others. Linda shined a penlight on Alana's injuries and gasped.
"I'll be all right," Alana managed to say.
"Cover your ears," Mark Murphy whispered urgently. He waited a beat, studying the array of winking flashlights over the touch hole of one of the soccer's great cannons. When he thought the time right, he slipped a timer pencil into the gun's touch hole, where it sank into the plastic explosives he'd rammed down the barrel. Between it and the muzzle was a cannonball made up of dozens of small metal spheres fused lightly together. The timer went off, detonating the plastique, and the gun belched the grape shot in a 10-foot tongue of flame. The ropes secured to the cannon to prevent the recoil from pushing it across the deck failed at full stretch, and the 2 tons of bronze rocketed through the opposite rail and plowed into the steep riverbank below the pier. The impact of the grape was lost in the gun's mighty roar, but when Murphy looked out to where he'd aimed, 2 of the 3 flashlights were no longer there. It was as if the cannon's blast had signaled the end of round 1 and the beginning of the 2nd. The gunman opened up with renewed fury, rounds chewing at the soccer as if to tear it apart piece by piece. The 3 corporation operatives fired back, but the weight of the onslaught kept them pinned. The cry of the terrorists' charge carried above the din. They were coming with everything they had. Eric took a glancing bullet to the shoulder when he tried to shoot back and stem the tide. Unable to hold his rifle against the wound to aim, he flicked to full auto and raked the ground 30 feet from the soccer's side, creating a curtain of lead the terrorists couldn't penetrate. When the rifle bolt snapped back on an empty magazine, Murphy took up the duty, blasting away in a desperate bid to break the charge. His gun, too, fell empty. Linda screamed like a Valkyrie as she hosed the dirt. It didn't matter if she hit anyone. The intention was just to keep the terrorists back long enough that their courage would fail and they'd retreat for cover. Bullets whizzed all around her, but to her absolute relief, she saw the muzzle flashes were coming from farther and farther away. The charge had broken. They had stopped them. She slipped down below the bulwarks, her entire body vibrating as an after-effect of her rifle's recoil, and she was covered in oily sweat. "You guys okay?" she called to her people as the gunman's fire slowed.
"I took one to the shoulder," Eric reported from the darkness.
"I'm still pissed at myself for not grabbing the night vision goggles from Link," Mark said bitterly.
"We go spelunking, and I forget the most important piece of gear we would need."
"Alana?"
"I'm here,"
she called softly, her voice pinched with pain.
"Mark, give her something from your med kit."
The sound of gunfire that had risen and fallen erratically over the past 10 minutes dribbled away to silence. Everyone's ears rang, but not badly enough to miss a man's voice calling out from the cavern entrance.
"I will give you this one chance to give yourselves up."
"Holy crap," Eric exclaimed.
"I know that voice."
"What? Who is it?"
"I listened in when he and the chairman were talking aboard the Oregon. That's the harbor pilot, Assad or something.
"That explains the ambush on the coast road," Murph surmised.
"Doesn't change anything for us, though."
Linda thought for a moment, then shouted back,
"I think General Austin McAuliffe said it best when he was asked to surrender during the Battle of the Bulge. In a word, nuts!"
Murph grumbled sarcastically.
"Oh, that'll go well for us."
Round 3 started in earnest.